Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast, where we're trying to learn to put off procrastinating, which is, well, a bit paradoxical, isn't it?
Tommy.
John, shall we dispense with our usual chit-chat and just crack straight on with this fantastic interview?
I'm suspecting here, Tommy.
What's that? What?
Is it maybe because you haven't done any writing this week?
Well, I mean, I suppose, might not have. I've been really busy, which is a tech we always say. Oh, it's fine. I've been
busy. Every time. Oh, just so busy with work, and you know how things conspire against you.
No, I haven't really.
You are refitting your kitchen.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff going on.
That's quite a good excuse.
I've got physical maladies going on. Got refurbished kitchen maladies going on. There's maladies everywhere at every turn.
There's a whole pile of
maladies. My life is
just
a horrible grey, melancholic mist at the minute, John. I'm just walking through the pea super of.
Which is why you want to get to a pre-recorded interview as soon as possible.
I would imagine that would be the best thing to do for everyone, really. I don't think I've got anything to... I just feel empty and spent. And I've thought about getting on with the writing, and I've just gone, oh, no, because no.
Not in the space.
Whereas sometimes it's an escape that you want to get to.
Yeah.
You know, if you just had like a busy day, you think, right, oh, I just want to get in the bubble of it.
Yeah.
Whereas I just don't feel like I have the impetus. So.
Oh, Tommy.
I think we're getting there,
I'd give you a hug if I was with
you. Thankful for small mercies. Let's not make things worse. Anyway, what have you been writing, John?
I haven't really been writing. I've been polishing, I would say.
There's only one word that comes after that, John, normally, in normal parlance. Like a Freudian slip on critique of your own writing there.
Yeah.
What have you been polishing, John? What can you polish? What do people polish? What's the phrase?
You make a fairly good point there, Tom.
Yeah.
What other word can I use? I've been editing.
I don't know.
There you go.
Have you been making a silk purse?
A pig's ear? A turd? No, my weird little fairy tale of my short story that I think I briefly told you about.
Yeah, yeah.
My God, have I been taking my sweet time about it as well. Yeah, well, as usual me. It makes me realise doing this just what a slow writer I actually am.
Yeah.
I am slow. I'm not.
It's amusing how very different creatures we are in that, because I'm very much a burst writer. I can write. But yet, interest, it's like the tortoise and the hare. And we still end up with the same depressingly small amount of writing at the end of it.
That's true.
You've just done it really slowly.
Yeah.
And I've had like a burst and then done nothing. Yeah. But we still end up with the same amount.
Yeah, I mean, I say that, but there are times where I can just barrel through it. I think sometimes it's like sometimes you're like a prophet. Do you know what I mean? You're speaking tongues. It's like you're interpreting the word of the great typewriter in the sky. Do you know what I mean?
It's coming out,
it's pouring out of you. But it definitely hasn't been that this week.
So have you been editing and moving stuff around? Like how in depth?
Yeah,
how...
just pathetically going, oh, that word doesn't quite work there. I mean,
oh, so you've been tweaking?
Yeah, pathetic tweaking.
So you've not been restructuring or like any of the stuff that makes you go, oh my God, we're doing it all.
No. I'm pretty happy with the sort of overall structure. I was going to say fine tuning, but you know what I mean. Just like really. The agonizing that John does a lot.
Oh, yeah, the Johnness.
Yeah, the whole John factor is going on.
Should he step or should he walk? Oh, my God!
And you know what's funny?
What if he wandered?
You know what's funny about the whole thing as well? Is that no one's ever going to read this, probably. Although I do have a thing in the back of my mind that maybe, you know, I might record it for the podcast or something. And that's quite good because it does make me focus my mind a little bit more, having the podcast.
Yeah.
So that's
good. Yeah, because you think someone actually is going to get consumed.
Possibly. Who knows?
So I do need to make a bit more. Yeah, you can't be quite so blasé. But then that puts more pressure on your little tinkering, doesn't it?
It does, and that's why I think
it
takes
so long.
And then
you're like, oh my God, this does matter.
So yeah, I just need to. Just need to move on with my life, Tom.
Yeah. No, I just imagine you coming up from your office and Kate saying, how's it going?
Like after you
spent an entire evening down there and you come up looking like disheveled, like you've been spending the day down a mine or something like that. Sweat pouring off you.
And I've moved 5 words and deleted 10.
you just say, I changed, looked, to glanced. Oh, well done, John. Well done.
Yeah,
very
evening
good.
Evening well spent.
Brilliant. Hey, at least you've done something.
Well, exactly. So that's a pretty much all I've got to say.
Yeah, we should introduce our guest really, because we didn't. We did a tease at the end of last episode, didn't we?
Did we not mention
who
it is? I
don't think we said who it was.
What?
Yeah,
it's a brilliant name as well. Okay, well, let's. I'm going to let you do it, Tommy.
Yeah, I was going to try and think of some cryptic clues.
Oh, that's good.
I couldn't really think of any.
Oh, should we just say his name then?
I don't want to really, yeah. I want to I like teasing people along.
Well, to so be fair, week, Tommy, it's at the top of this podcast, so they already know.
It's literally the name of the podcast, isn't it?
They probably already guessed.
That is a give-up, yeah. So we're talking to Mark Billingham, like it says on the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talk to him about all kinds of things. Obviously, his writing and stuff, but we have a good chat with him about his weird hobbies and things, which is nice. And of course, his time in Maid Marian and His Merry Men, for people of a certain age, that was a massive kids' TV thing.
Yeah,
and
big
he was
role, big role.
A fantastic character in that. So that does come up. But yeah, without further ado, let's have a chat with Mark Billingham.
Mark Billingham. What have you been writing this week?
Well,
are you allowed to actually tell us?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually combing through a finished first draft of my 2024 book,
right?
Which is the second in my new series, and I've got to the end of, you know, I've done a first draft of that, so I've been spending the last few days just reading it through, trying to improve stuff to knock the rough edges off. So yeah, not so much writing as reading and tweaking.
Have you done the old things? You stuck it away for a couple of weeks and have come back to it fresh.
Yeah, I did. I finished it a couple of weeks ago and then went on holiday.
Oh, nice.
And tried not to think about it.
Yeah, good.
And it's such a useful trick anyway, just stepping away from something for a while, and then you look at it again, and sometimes the answer to problems that have been plaguing you just become really obvious. Also, you just look at a paragraph and go, "That's rubbish. I can make a much better job of that." So, yeah, that's the stage I'm at now.
I was going to say, mostly, presumably, what you're reading, you're quite liking, or are you going, "Oh, this is bad. This is bad."
Mostly, I am, which is possibly foolish, and you know, self-delusional, but. No, it's kind of all right. And again, it's that stepping away. I think you know, quite often I'll, you know, step away from the computer at the end of the day, then read through the next morning what I've written the day before and, you know, delete most of it. but having stepped away for a couple of weeks and then come back to it, I'm like, yeah, this is all right. I mean, you know, it's nowhere near finished. It's not really even in a state to deliver. It's not far away.
Right.
It's not far away because I'm not one of those writers who just presses on. I'm not one of those like sharks that have to keep moving. I know plenty of writers are, who just, if they're struggling for a bit, or they'll just go, oh, you know, bit with copper, bit with suspect.
Right.
And they'll just press on until they get to the end and then go back.
Yeah, I can't do that.
And fill in all the blanks. I cannot do that. No. I cannot write chapter two until I'm absolutely happy with chapter one. So by the time I get to the end of a so-called first draft, it's like 101st draft. And it's in pretty good shape.
Right, yeah.
And I've got a weird OCD thing about, you know, if I deliver a manuscript and my editor spots a typo, I'm just furious. You know, I want it to be really, really clean so that the editing process is fairly minimal after that, hopefully.
What's your favourite bit of the whole writing process? Is it that first idea and the draft, or is
no,
it?
No, God, no.
Don't say finishing the book, because that's everybody's favourite.
Of course. I mean, you know, I think it was Dorothy Parker when somebody said, "Do you enjoy writing?" She said, "I enjoy having written." You know, starting a book is torture. It's absolute torture. And doesn't matter how many you've written, you sit down in front of a blank screen and it takes you kind of 100 pages before you think, okay, I might get away with it.
Is it harder the more you've written, do you think?
Oh, of course it is. And you know what?
Your well becomes more empty and you think, oh, no, I kind of did that idea. Did I do that idea before?
You've used up all your best ideas. You've spunked them all away. And also there is that kind of pressure that's both good and bad.
Course,
there's a commercial pressure, obviously, because you know, your publisher wants you to sell a few more copies this time than you did last time and all that stuff. But also you're trying to write a better book. I mean, you have to have that ambition. Again, it doesn't matter how many books you've written, whether you're on your second book or your 42nd book, you're still trying to. Now, obviously you won't always write a better book. Yeah. But you have to have that ambition. So yeah, sitting down to start a book is always torture.
Yeah, it's weird though, isn't it? Because as if you've written a popular series, then you've got a fan base there that's willing to buy your next one.
Yeah,
regardless.
But because of that, there is
it's kind of like a double-edged sword
because I hope I'm not one of those writers, but I think I know some writers who take that for granted and therefore go, well, you know what?
Type, blah, blah, blah.
Seeing with those characters, yeah. You start, you know, you can start to phone it in if you're not around, which is one of the reasons I'm writing a new series. So, I don't want to be one of those writers who writes essentially the same book over and over again.
Yeah,
is that one of the reasons that you've written a couple of standalone novels as well?
Yeah.
Is that partly just to give you a bit of time off, or is that just because the idea didn't quite fit Tom Thorpe?
No, it was completely that. I mean, I kind of knew. You know, before I would be finishing whatever the Tom Thorne book was, I would know that next one's going to be a standalone.
Coming up for some air,
having a break, spending a year doing something different, and then hopefully going back to your series a bit more fired up.
Yeah.
That's the theory. I mean, it's always, you know, stepping out of your comfort zone. I mean, it's called a comfort zone for a reason, isn't it? You know, you do get 50 pages into the new thing and start going, oh, why did I do this? I could have just written another series novel. And, you know, because there's also that worry that readers, when the thing's done, and there are some of those readers who'll just go, oh no, it's not Tom Thorne book, I'm not interested. And so, you know, you have to work that little bit harder. You know, obviously you have a fan base and they will read whatever you write, and you hope you will encourage readers who haven't read you before at all. But, you know, there will always be those readers who go, no, it's not what I want. And what I want is a book that's almost the same as the last one, just not quite.
See, that's a weird thing with that genre, though, isn't it, particularly?
Yeah.
It must be so hard as a writer to know how far to step out of your lane whilst keeping one foot firmly planted in, because otherwise everyone's just going to go, well, that's not the right kind. That's ridiculous. That's not ticking any of the boxes. There's so much stuff you've got to kind of tick as you're going through. But
You're right. It is about ticking boxes. There are, so, you know, it's like when you go and see your favourite band. The last thing you want to hear is we're going to play a lot of tracks from our new album. You know, you know what I mean? You want the hits and you want the songs you know. And, you know, and as a reader, I'm exactly the same. You know, I suddenly don't want my favourite police procedural crime writer to be writing a thriller set in space, or, you know, a thriller set in the 14th century. And that's selfish of me. Why shouldn't they? You know, they should do exactly what they want and tell whatever story they want to tell.
Hey, as long as it's got an alcoholic detective in it, you're laughing, aren't you?
That's all you need. That's one of the boxes you've got to tick.
But, I mean, that's a great example of it, though, isn't it? You've got to either find a way to have an alcoholic detective that's somehow in a different... Do you mean there's a different angle on it, or there's got to be something
broken in some way, haven't they?
The strange thing is, I don't have an alcoholic detective. I have a detective who has a beer every now and again.
Yeah.
But you know, the strange thing is, you know, American readers think he's an alcoholic just because he has a beer every now and again.
Another beer?
Like, oh God, is somebody going to stage an intervention? Oh my God, he's got a problem.
Because he'll happily just reach for.
There was one scene in the pub. Chill out. You know.
I was saying to John before when we were talking about this interview coming up. I think with Tom Thorne, it's more like he's just his constant grazing.
He does like
his
eating,
food.
Yeah.
He's always got a sandwich on the go.
But you know what? That's one of the things. Yeah. Sometimes I get to the end of a book and I might have really enjoyed it. I mean, I'm talking about as a reader. And then I'll suddenly go, he never ate anything. She never ate anything. They never just did ordinary things. You know, I'm not saying you have to write constant scenes of your characters going to toilet three times.
See, and then Tom Thorne went for a poo.
Tom Thorne spent half an hour in the toilet, you know, watching TikTok videos. But
it was a particularly tricky trip. It reminded me of the case back in 98.
Yeah. But no, if you know, he needs to have a sandwich or an Indian takeaway now and again, why shouldn't he?
Yeah, let's give him that.
If you're enjoying this episode of the Failing Writers Podcast, we'd be dead chuffed if you take the time to leave us a nice little review. Thanks muchly.
I was going to ask, is Tom Thorne, is he based on anyone? Where did he come from? Where did main characters appear from?
Look, he wasn't even supposed to be the main character, you know, 20-odd years ago when I started. I wanted the central character in that first book to be the victim of the crime. I wanted to write about victims because I was heartily sick of reading endless police procedurals where you had a cop and a killer and they're on this collision course. And meanwhile, there's 12 or 15 victims that have been slaughtered. You don't even find out anything about them. You know, you don't get to care about them or engage with them. So I wanted to write slightly from a victim's point of view. I needed a copper because a crime had been committed. So I just slapped one on the page and I gave him a name and I knew nothing about him. I mean, I knew nothing. And to this day, readers who've read all the books know as much about him as I do. There is no Bible.
I think that's lovely.
Well, it was just laziness, I think, at the time.
That's probably what appeals to me, to be honest.
I'm glad I did it because that way he is hopefully unpredictable. He can surprise me and then therefore he can surprise the readers. The flip side of that is, though, I muck things up. You know, I'll occasionally get an email going, why are his eyes brown in book 3 and green in book 6? You know, stuff like that.
And you just send an email going, well, wait for the next book, because that's very interesting, actually, by that.
Oh, bollocks. I don't have all that stuff written down. I wrote a prequel a few years ago, a prequel to the series set in 1996. When his parents were still alive and all this sort of stuff. And I had to go and ask my wife what Thorne's mum was called, you know, because I wasn't going to go back and read the bloody books, God forbid. And I just couldn't remember and I hadn't written it down anywhere. So that stuff happens, but I'm still glad I've done it that way. So I know he has become who he is. He kind of was a bit of a blank slate when I, you know, so he's the sum total of his experiences, really. I mean, I've got to know him over, you know, 19 books.
Yeah.
But no, didn't know anything about him when I first started writing.
That reminds me, you were talking about Sleepyhead then, presumably, when you...
Yeah.
I was just thinking about series. And I love how crime authors often have a sort of a link between their titles to flag that they're by the same author.
Yeah.
And I noticed that your first three books are Sleepyhead, Scaredy Cat, and Lazy Bones.
Yeah.
And then you're
and then I wisely stop.
But you got to, there's a time, isn't there, where you either jump out and you can change, or if you go too far, then that's it, you're stuck.
Well, where was I going to go after that?
Well, listen, Mark, I've come up with some new ones for you.
Oh, yeah, go on.
I've got Sweetie Pie.
Nice.
That's like a kind of Sweeney Todd type adventure. Grumpy Chops. Silly Billy.
Yeah.
About a 17th century playwright.
Right.
Obviously, that's probably not a Tom Thorne.
No, maybe not.
Silky Skills, about a killer who strangles footballers.
Okay.
And Bloody Wanker.
Okay.
I mean, that last one, that's pretty much written itself already. So I'll give you those.
Okay, cheers. Well, I mean, those first three books were kind of a trilogy in that, you know, they were not dissimilar books, you know, structurally or in. So, you know, the fourth one I deliberately made very different, and it wasn't just a change of title. And I remember the first review that book got, which is a book called The Burning Girl, fourth book. The first review was, what a shame that Billingham has changed a winning formula. And I remember being quite cross, not just because he didn't like the book, but also, the fact that it was a formula meant that I had to change it. Kind of, you don't want to be formulaic.
That's the exact point.
You
know,
even after three books, if you feel that you know, stuck in a bit of a rut, you do something different. Mm. So,
and you know full well, if book four had been in the same formula, it would have been I'm afraid it's just more of the same.
Oh, this again. Yeah.
Really
more of
the
same. Yawn. Yeah, absolutely. You can't win from that point of view.
Anymore,
you can't. You can't really worry about reviews and stuff. I worry about what readers think. I do worry about what readers think because I write kind of from a reader's point of view. I write with an invisible reader over my shoulder. You know, how are they reading this book? How are they experiencing this book? How is this making them feel? And so, if readers get back to me, and I do get a lot of communication from readers, you know, and emails and Twitter and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm slightly, you know, I'm much more kind of affected in a way if a reader goes, oh, I feel a bit let down by that or, you know, than a critic.
Yeah.
You know, even though what the critic says is more public, it's, you know, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to, I'll give you a good example in a minute. So, you know, if a reader says to me, oh, no, I don't think Thorne should be with that woman. He should chuck her and, you know, get together with Phil or whatever it might be. I'm not necessarily going to do what they say. But sometimes, so I wrote a book, it was a standalone book called In the Dark. And there was a character in it who is not real. There was a character in it who was kind of imaginary, who was a sort of the personification of another character's guilt. Not a ghost, absolutely not a ghost, but someone this character would talk to, and you later realise that this person had been dead for a while. And I got a lot of emails, and I still do, from people going, I don't get it, this character Laura, who is she? Is she alive? Is she dead? Is she a ghost? What's going on? And back then when I got all those emails, this was after the hardback had come out, I thought, I've messed up here. I thought I was being really elegant and obvious and clear, and there was a little sentence somewhere that explained it, but it just wasn't enough, so I rewrote it.
Oh, wow.
I rewrote it between hardback and paperback, just because I hadn't done my job properly. I'd messed up. You know, I just didn't want readers not, you know, I wasn't trying to be obtuse. I just didn't make, I just, you know, too bloody elegant for my own good. Right. And I just made it clear.
It's very satisfying, though, for the people who did spot it, probably. Do you know what I mean? The,
yeah.
the more obscure it is sometimes.
And they've all jumped on the review things going, well, he's ruined the paperback.
Yeah, for God's sake.
Yeah. Speaking of worrying about what people think, do you ever worry what your friends and family think about you when you come up with horrible ways of killing people?
Not really.
What's the way of killing someone that you're most proud of coming up with?
Oh, well, I've just killed somebody with a nail gun, which I'm very proud of. Just pressed up against an ear.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, somebody nail gunned and they're then welded to a fridge. and this is my new cozy series. I'm particularly proud of that. I think I've pretty much done everything.
Yeah,
although actually there's probably nothing more twisted than what was going on in Sleepyhead, which is still the book I get the most feedback from. And and I knew I was onto something when that book came out and I started doing a few events. Several times people fainted when I was reading this passage out.
Really?
And I thought, oh, this is probably
that's
good.
Hit a nerve.
You know, nothing gratuitous, no blood and gore and guts at all. It was just about somebody putting their hands on the back of somebody's neck and moving their fingers into a particular position and manipulating arteries and all that kind of stuff. And I just watched a couple of people fall off chairs at readings. And I thought, oh, hello. It's just that thing of being, you know, trapped in your own body, that sort of worst nightmare thing of not really being alive and not really being dead. That's it. We talked about spunking all your best ideas away early. I think I did.
All in the first book.
All in the first book. All downhill from
there. How long had that one been knocking around in your head then, or been written or part written? Or
do you know what, I had so much luck with that book. I'd been hanging around the fringes of the sort of crime fiction community for years, going to conventions, interviewing authors, reviewing books, doing all that. And then I went away on holiday and I thought, I'm gonna have a go at this. And I'd had this idea, and I, you know, this horrible thing called locked-in syndrome, what could you do it to somebody on purpose? And my wife, who's a TV director, was directing Casualty. Mm. And she said, listen, why don't you come in and talk to our kind of medical advisor, who's an amazing guy called Phil Coburn. And I spoke to him and he said, oh my God, that is such a sick idea. But there was this glint in his eye. And he went away and did a bit of research and said, well, it'd be fiendishly difficult, really difficult. And if you got it wrong by so much as a millimeter, you'd kill them. And that's when this sort of light bulb went off and I went, I've got it. That's exactly what it's the serial killer who isn't actually trying to kill anybody. And I went away on holiday and I scribbled in his notebook every night. And by the time the holiday had finished, I'd written about 30,000 words. And I thought, hang on a minute, that's about a third of a book. This is, you know, they were 30,000 rubbish words.
But oh, my God, just, this is real.
Well, suddenly it's not so daunting anymore.
Yeah.
The idea of trying to write 100,000 words, you know. So, and I tarted those 30,000 words off and I sent them off and a couple of agents were interested and I signed with an agent and she sent it round and like a bunch of publishers wanted it and there was an auction and it was done. And I only wrote 30,000
words.
Don't
you hate it when that happens?
I know. And listen, I've spoken to so many writers since and I well realise how incredibly lucky that was. But yeah, I got my book deal on those 30,000 words.
Wow.
But then I had to finish the book and then write another one. But yeah, I was very lucky with it.
So having written... How many is it? It's like 20-something crime novels.
23.
23. Because myself and the absent member of the podcast, Dave, we're both attempting to write a crime novel at the moment. Is there anything you've learned along the way that, like, you wish that you'd known earlier in your career? Any advice for those attempting to write a riveting?
Well, I wish I'd made my lead character younger. you know, I didn't write my first novel until I was pushing 40, so I made him the same age as me. And I aged him in real time for a while. And then I realized I was running out of road. So what I did was just make the decision that even though there's a year between books, there's not necessarily a year between cases. You know, next year's book might start the day after the last book finished. So he's, you know, I'm still aging, but he's slowed up a bit. I'd have made him a lot younger. Anything else? I didn't realize, obviously, you just don't know how important a good editor is. I've been very lucky. I've only had three editors in 23 years. And they've all been brilliant. I've only ever had one publisher. I've only ever had one agent. Mm. That's because I'm fiercely loyal and a coward. I know a lot of authors who jump around that way. You know, some journeyman footballers do, and they'll just go in search of the next payday with the next club. And do you know what?
Some people do that when you go down the pub as well, don't they? really annoys me, that. You know, you get a comfy seat somewhere in a pub and a nice pint, and they go, right, where are we going next?
Yeah, no, I'm happy here. Listen, if there's nothing wrong, yeah, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I mean, I think I learned that. I think I learned the value of staying somewhere where people are good to you and you have a good experience and you get on with people. You know, if publishers mess up, then yeah, a writer's got every right to go, no, do you know what? I've been with you a while and things aren't going well. I'm going to go see where else I can, you know, have a new adventure. I've been very happily with the same place. So I've had very good editors. I've had incredibly good copy editors and publicists. I've been very lucky.
Just tell us one thing that went wrong, Mark, just something. Yeah, with a Failing Writers podcast. Yeah. We need to hear.
Something that went wrong. There was a misprint once. There was of my name.
Oh, okay. That's quite good.
On the jacket of a book. And there's still a few of them floating around. There was, when the TV series was made, there were like TV tie-in editions, you know, with pictures of actors on the front, the way they do. Yeah, yeah. So they put these out. They put Sleepyhead and Scaredy Cat out as TV tie-in editions and missed the A out of my surname. So I got sent these books and it was like, your books are on the way. And I just opened them very happily and went, Mark Billingham, you know, and the horror... The sort of silent 30 seconds of horror when I told my editor. And they just, it was one of those things where they said, well, look, we can pulp them all, but if we do that, then you're going to miss the sell-in date at Tesco's or whatever it was. Yeah. So I just went, oh, sod it. So every so often I'll get, you know, a reader will go, I think you'll find they've misspelt your name. Yes, I know. So certain things go wrong in production. But I have been very lucky. I haven't had any sort of horrible experiences. And I, you know, crime writers especially are very close. We're a very sort of tight-knit gang.
Yeah.
So when stuff does go wrong for people, you find out about it.
Right.
So I do know writers who've had awful experiences with publishers. Mm. We're going through some awful experiences with publishers right now. And, you know, I just count myself very lucky.
Well, that's good.
Well, long may it continue.
Oh, yeah.
Is it true that you have a massive and impressive collection of crime novels?
I've got quite a few crime novels. Yeah, I mean, I was a sort of, I have that collecting gene. I collect far too many things in far too many categories. But I started out as a collector of kind of first edition crime fiction. So yeah, I've got, and I was a nutter about it. I would have to have the UK first, the US first, the proof if I could get it. And eventually, and I mean, it's actually sort of how I got into writing, because my wife has said, look, you've got to find some way to get these books for free, because this is costing us a bloody fortune. So I started reviewing.
Right, okay.
So that's how I started to get free books.
You're reading a lot of crime fiction.
Yeah. And, you know, I started not to be so crazy about it, so I'd just have the UK first if it was a UK author, and the US first if it was a US author. And so, it, you know, they started, so that immediately cut the collection down by two-thirds. And, yeah, and actually now I only go sort of collect books by writers I really like, rather than, you know, if somebody said to me, oh, this is really collectible, I go, oh, how much? I'll have it. You know, such an idiot. And now, and these days, I'm collecting fewer books and collecting far more bits of pointless Beatles memorabilia and dolls and stuffed animals and guitars and anything else I've become crazy about.
It's interesting the mindset of a collector.
You never kind of lose it.
Compulsion, isn't it?
And as I say, now it's switched to, if almost anything to do with the Beatles, any dolls or, you know, old posters or a tin tray or virtually anything that's got the Beatles on it, I will.
Do you go hunting this stuff out, Mark, or does it just?
I do. Now, of course, you can hunt it out online. Yeah. But if I'm ever at any kind of antiques fair,
that's what I imagined. Yeah, trawling through the stuff.
Yeah, no, I can't.
Running through the halls. I've got a badge.
Yeah, I've got a badge with John Lennon on it. Look at this.
Yeah.
I know, it is crackers. It is crackers. I'm a grown man. It's ridiculous. I mean, a lot of these things are toys. I mean, I'm glad this is sound only, because otherwise you'd see behind me, I'm sitting here in my office and I'm kind of surrounded by this nonsense. I mean, even just looking, I can spot at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like at least a dozen dolls of John Lennon. And Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr and George Harrison, just China dolls, paper dolls, pottery, just any bloody anything. Bobbleheads, anything, fridge magnets, whatever it might be.
I love the fact that you sound slightly annoyed with yourself.
I'm looking at the shelf now, and this is just a small shelf, and it has, I guess, what you'd call action figures of various sizes. And moving along the line, I've got Scott Tracy out of Thunderbirds, Edgar Allan Poe, Elvis Costello, Johnny Cash, Bender, the robot out of Futurama, Dick Dastardly, Sherlock Holmes, Anchorman, the guy from Breaking Bad, Wile E. Coyote, and Kenneth Williams in Carry On Clear. That's one shelf, small shelf of action figures. It's wrong, yeah, isn't it? It's really wrong.
Wow. What does it say about
it? But there you go.
Yeah.
But it makes it... Do you know what? I think that's probably why I can't write anywhere else. I can only write in my office. I'm not somebody who can write in a hotel or on a train or anything like that. And I need to be kind of surrounded by this stuff. I need to look at it and go, oh, yeah, there's my weird Captain Scarlet figure and there's Alfred, there's my Hank Williams.
I better get this book finished because I do actually need to be paid because I'm spending a fortune on this ridiculous, ridiculous stuff. Good motivation. Good motivation.
So you were saying that now you only collect writers that you really like.
Yes.
Who were they? Who are the titans of crime fiction?
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Who are the titans?
Yeah, who's your top three?
Top three. Oh, blimey. Okay.
In no particular order. I mean, let's make it easy.
No particular order. Do you know what? Most of them are probably American.
Right, okay.
I got a bit of a think.
I don't know. I mean, because that's how I kind of start. You know, I started reading all those American hard-boiled writers. Oh. You know, there was one book really that changed everything for me, which was the five great Dashiell Hammett novels. There was a kind of Picador edition of those novels in one volume, which was amazing. George Pelecanos, who is an amazing Washington writer, James Lee Burke, who Michael Connelly. Who I adore. And you know, two of those writers are now very good friends of mine, which I still have to pinch myself about. Because, you know, these Michael Connelly, I remember going back in those days before I was published, when I was reviewing books, I went to interview Michael in about 1998 at his publisher's office in London, you know, shaking like a leaf with a kind of dictaphone. Yeah. And now, you know, Mike and I are good buddies. And that is the good thing, as I say, that thing about the crime fiction gang. It's very welcoming. Mm. There are a few bad apples, as there are in any group of people. When not all saints, and not all by any means nice and lovely and gregarious and welcoming. But
no serial killers.
No, it's a gang. You know,
that's why everyone's nice to each other, John, isn't it? Because they're just not quite sure whether these are the people are.
There is that. There is that.
Got these ideas of how to kill people. Be nice to them.
Somebody once said that crime writers were the smokers of the literary community, and I kind of know what they mean.
Yeah,
it's that thing of, you know, the slightly bad, slightly naughty boys and girls who are just over in the corner or just outside the door and outside the back door looking like they're having fun. Yeah, we know how to have a party.
It's criminal. What a great, great writer I am. I type the word using me hands. La la la, like that, so easy I don't understand. What's the big deal? Just like Billingham. Pages I see, I'm filling them with so many great phrases like William Shakespeare. Probably, sort of.
Just realised how much like Orville that sounds.
I wanted to talk to you, Mark, a little bit about going before you were a successful novelist. You were doing stand-up.
I was.
Which I wasn't really aware of until researching for this. Obviously, I knew you from Maid Marian, because that was amazing.
Happy days.
My daughter, who's nine, I've been watching them on YouTube.
Oh, cool.
She absolutely loves it.
I was still the best job I've ever had. I just ran around in a forest with a big sword for four or five years.
Just looking a bit dozy.
It was great. What a great job.
So in some ways, was that kind of the start of everything then?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of how I became a writer. I mean, I was a jobbing actor. And I'd been in all sorts of old nonsense. And, you know, one day I auditioned for this new kids comedy drama written by Tony Robinson and got the job. And by the time the series was ending, by the time it was in its fourth season, Tony, who was getting very busy, you know, doing Time Team and all that kind of stuff, he said, look, I know you, right? I knew I did stand up. And he said, look, do you want to help write the final series? So I did. So when the series ended, I had by default become a television writer.
Yeah.
And, you know, spent a few fairly unhappy years for the most part writing for TV, which is not a lot of fun. I mean, whenever I do it, whenever I dip my toes into the murky waters of television, it reminds me why I write books.
What sort of stuff were you writing on then? What was the...
I was writing a lot of kids' comedy, drama, kids' animation, lots of stuff for the Cartoon Network back in the day. And, you know, you'll write something and you'll get notes from 10 people in 10 different countries, you know, because it's all co-funded, and there's money from France, there's money from Liechtenstein. Oh, so you get all these notes. They conflict with one another. You're on the 15th draft and they're asking you to put stuff back in. You took out 3 drafts ago, or to add some stuff that they told you to take out.
Yeah.
And eventually you stop caring. Eventually you just go, do you know what? I don't even want my name on this anymore. I did find it very hard, and then sort of stand up, which I was doing at the same time, sort of took over. And the other day I suddenly realized I did stand up for about 20 years, and you know, for the most part loved it, and still sometimes miss it.
I miss the
20 minutes or the 40 minutes on stage. I miss that. I miss the buzz of that. I don't miss driving up and down motorways. I don't miss sitting in shitty dressing rooms at 3 o'clock in the morning. So there's a lot about it I don't miss, but there's a lot I do. I still, I'm very close with I was playing poker today with half a dozen comics who are old friends. So I know what's going on the circuit still, and I keep my, ear to the ground. But yeah, I loved it. I got to travel all over the world doing it, and made some very good friends. So, but it's, do you know what? It's not a job for somebody my age.
Yeah, it's a young man's game.
Well, it is. It bloody well is. I mean, I can remember the point very clearly, and this is when I was still doing it, when I looked out at an audience of students, because there was a kind of student circuit,
which was
great because you could do a lot of gigs. But I looked out and I was doing, knob jokes and routines about sex or whatever it might be. And I remember thinking, I'm just like their dirty uncle. This is wrong. This is really wrong. You know, once the audience are young enough to be your children, you could easily be your children then. You've got to switch what you do. So, no.
And there's a point where you get in life as well, isn't it, where it's like all of a sudden you sort of... someone says, oh yeah, blah blah blah, and then it'll be 2 o'clock before 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
There's an age where it's like all of a sudden that's like the biggest challenge in the world.
Listen,
you're in your 20s or something, like, yeah, whatever, cool, and then we'll go out drinking after that.
I'm
shall
tucked
we?
Up in bed with a hot milky drink by half past nine.
Exactly. It's just certain
the
stuff.
Idea
like,
of sitting in the dressing room at the comedy store at 2 o'clock. I did a lot of comparing at the comedy store, which I thoroughly enjoyed. It's the best comedy club in the country, or arguably the world, and I was comparing there a lot. But when you're comparing, there used to be 2 shows on a Friday night, 2 shows on a Saturday night, a show that starts at midnight. So you are literally sitting there half asleep at 2 o'clock in the dressing room waiting for the final act to come off stage because you have to go back on and wind the show up and then go home. And you go home and you're sort of buzzing a little bit because, you've done this show, and you eat at 3 in the morning and you're buzzing. By the time I'd got young kids, that was just becoming an impossibility. With young kids then jumping on you 2 hours later going, time to get up. I can't do this much longer.
It's tiring just listening to that, to be honest. I'm exhausted.
It was fun though, don't get me wrong. I mean, like I say, it is a buzz like nothing else. And I still have to get my performing jollies somewhere. I get them in other ways. I get them doing some cheap jokes at literary festivals, doing kind of different sorts of shows at literary festivals, doing knob gags and doing shows with this rock band that I'm in with a bunch of other crime writers. And that's so much
fun. I saw a bit about that. What's the band called?
The Fun Loving Crime Writers.
That's right, yeah. And there was just a nice line about murdering songs, which was
it started off as a bit of fun. I mean, it still is enormous fun, but it was just, oh, listen, let's do this. This will be fun. Somebody, a few of us stumbled up on stage at like an open mic night at the World Mystery Convention in New Orleans a few years ago and did a couple of numbers. And, somebody put it on YouTube, and then Edinburgh Book Festival said, right, we want you to do an hour and a half in August. And we went, eight. We only know 3. So we sort of put this band together because we'd all done bits and bobs with each other over the years at various places. Mm. Put this band together, think, oh, this will, be fun for about 5 minutes. And then 2 years later, we played Glastonbury.
Wow.
So it was sort of like, okay, this is getting a bit serious now. And it's great. We're back on the road. Next show is in May at IWrite in Glasgow. And then we've got basically a show or two every month for the rest of the year. And it's enormous fun.
So what was it like doing Glastonbury then? What was that experience like? That must have been mental.
That was proper bucket list stuff. I was the one that got the phone call. And because it's the kind of thing you make jokes about, isn't it? Glastonbury. I got the phone call, so I got to email the rest of the band, and the subject line of the email was, "This is not a joke. We are genuinely
this is not a drill.
Playing on the acoustic stage at Glastonbury." And, you know, yeah, in this massive tent with thousands of people. And the best thing was we turned up, and I don't know if you remember, but so this Glastonbury 2019, it was ludicrously hot. I mean, incredibly hot. And in the backstage area, you have your own fridge. So there's a row of fridges with the name of all the bands on. So, you know, you've got Hawkwind, Keane, and then us. There's our fridge. We're all taking pictures of our fridge. But because we were so absurdly thrilled to be asked, when we got asked to submit our entertainment rider, I just went, a couple of cans of beer and a bottle of red wine.
Did they take
so there was a couple of cans of beer and a bottle of wine, which we got through in about 15 seconds.
And then we started on Blur's fridge. Theirs was
back. No, we started on Hawkwind's. Right. It was Hawkwind's fridge because Stuart came over and he said, Stuart, forgive the accent, but Stuart's from Belfast. And Stuart, have you seen what's in Hawkwind's fridge? So there was all the alcohol in the world in Hawkwind's fridge. So we tucked into that a bit, and we're a bit more bolshy about our riders these days.
You probably saved that.
It was awesome. Stuart was wearing a t-shirt that said "Best midlife crisis ever." it's tremendous fun. But it's that thing about just being with five other people, because as you know, writing is a very solitary experience, or it should be. So the chance to collaborate with one other person, let alone five, is amazing. And we're all good mates, and we just have if we're doing a gig, we're away for a weekend together, and you know, it's the time you spend in the pub before and after that is the most fun, you know.
Or Hawkwind's fridge, whichever's nearest.
Yeah, or Hawkwind's fridge. But I never thought I would be doing this at 61 years of age, living out my rock star fantasies. And it's great.
Have you got? Have you got anything else on the bucket list?
Yeah. Do you know what?
A lot of things have been ticked off.
I have ticked a few things off. I was thinking about this the other day. I would love to do a radio show. I would desperately love to do a radio show.
Go on then. What's your radio show? Pitch it.
So I've done a couple of these things. There used to be a show on BBC Six Music called Paperback Writers, where they give you an hour.
Yeah.
And you can pick. I think you can. So you select all the music, and you pick in a dozen tracks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're talking about them and how they influenced you and your work and whatever it might be. And I did that a couple of times and just bloody loved it. But I'd love to have a couple of hours on the radio every week where I can do that. So obviously I program the music, but also I have guests on, I have people phoning in. I just love doing radio. That's a big ambition. I'd love to take that one on. So if anybody's listening, I'm available.
You've done Stab in the Dark podcast.
Yeah,
haven't you?
Which I thought.
Are you still doing?
Haven't done that for a couple of years. I suppose that's as close to doing a radio show. Well, you guys know. I thoroughly enjoyed doing that podcast. And again, it was just about getting mates on. Sometimes there were other writers, there were actors, TV directors, producers, anybody that worked within the area of crime drama, either in, you know, on the page or on the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
And just nattering, like we're doing now, just nattering for an hour. And, you know, the time flies by. And, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed that.
I've got a technical question for you. It's a bit of a boring question, but I do wonder about this. Because
I think it builds up well, though, John. I think everyone's looking forward to it.
This better be good.
You're a drama student. You've never worked for the police, I'm guessing.
No.
I've never.
He was a guard for the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yes, I was a guard for the Sheriff of Nottingham. Pretty close.
Your police procedural knowledge from. Yeah. No, I was wondering, where did that all come from? Was that just a lot of research, or do you have a police consultant for your books?
For the first few books, it was A Wing and a Prayer and the internet.
Oh, you see, that's what I'm doing at the moment, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's all it can be, because back then, you couldn't just ring the police. I would ring up the Metropolitan Police Press Office and ask some questions and be put through to somebody who put me through to somebody else, and I would kind of get nowhere. So I was sort of making it up for a book or two. And then by the time I could show them some books and go, look, I'm not a nutcase, you know, because you can't just ring up and go, listen, I'd like to talk to you about a hypothetical serial killer.
You're on a list.
They'd go, yeah. I mean, Ian Rankin once went into a police station with a similar kind of request and was held for questioning. So, but then they did assign me a detective, right? They assigned me a detective who was a detective inspector at Homicide, who later became the head of anti-terror, who really rose through the ranks and is now retired. And if he couldn't answer some questions, he'd be able to, no, this isn't about murder, this is about kidnap, so I'll talk to my kidnap unit and blah, blah, blah. So I did have people I could talk to. He, of course, would only tell me what he was allowed to tell me. So I also fostered some relationships with coppers socially, you know, there was a copper who was the parent at the same school my kids went to. So I'd occasionally ring him up and go, do you fancy a pint? And it's not, he would not then just answer the questions I had, but he would tell me amazing stories. And they're the things that wind up in the books. You know, they're the things that people go, God, that could never happen. And you go, no, that did happen. And these days there are a couple of people who actually make a living out of being, there's a guy called Graham Bartlett, who's now also a novelist, just published his second crime novel, but he's a retired detective. And, you know, he can offer all sorts of advice and assistance and runs all sorts of courses and stuff. And there are people in forensics who run all these courses, forensic anthropologists, CSIs, all that stuff is out there. So really, and books, there's so many books about that stuff now. But yeah, early on, I was just making stuff up.
And that's good. Good to know.
I wonder what you'd be like if you actually did get arrested for a serious crime, Mark. Yeah. It'd be weird, wouldn't it? Because you kind of know the inside track.
It would be
it.
Turned into a story.
Yeah. Definitely called falsely accused. It is definitely called falsely accused. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
Brackets.
Yeah.
I got away with it.
I know where the bodies are buried.
But it would be weird, wouldn't it, being in the classic police interview situation, that like being in the middle of the kind of the crime novel and being...
Yeah, and I mean, do you know what? When I, on those rare occasions, I do get close to that world. I mean, you know, I've been into prisons. I've done stuff in prisons, and I've done a couple of overnight ride-alongs with the police. Where I've been essentially a policeman for the night. You know, I've got a stab vest and a radio and I'm in a police car tearing around South London on a night shift. I mean, the first one I did, there was a body after 10 minutes. Jeez. And I was with these two amazing female officers who were filthy, by the way, just filthy. I mean, I actually based a character on one of them because, you know, you wouldn't believe the stuff that came out of her mouth. And, you know, they literally went, you all right with the body? And I'm like, yes, I'd never seen a body. Not like that. And suddenly I'm in a front room and there's this old woman dead on the floor in front of me. And at the end of the night, there was a road traffic accident and there were three or four bodies scattered about on the bloody road. This was one night shift. Yeah. So sometimes when I have got close to it, I think, you know what? I think I'd rather keep the distance. You know, I couldn't do it. Mm. You get asked that a lot. Could you be a police? God, no. God, not in a million years.
When's your next Tom Thorne out?
Well, the next Tom Thorne won't be out for a couple of years because...
That's not what people want to hear, Mark.
But you know what? It's ever so strange. So I've just hit pause. I haven't stopped writing about Thorne. I've just hit pause to start this new series, the first of which is a book called The Last Dance, comes out in May. And like I said, I've just finished the second one. And then I will start the next Thorne novel. And once this new series was kind of announced on social media and stuff... You know, the majority of people happily were like, oh, looking forward to this, a new series, you know, let's see.
Were there some sulky people having a little sulk?
There's one guy who keeps posting on my Twitter feed. There's one guy who basically goes, well, I'm not buying that. I'm not having that. Sort of like I've somehow, like, I don't know, I've insulted him somehow.
You should give him, send him a, you know, say, well, actually, Tom Thorne is in it. Just tell him.
Well, do you know what? Actually, he is.
Tom
Thorne makes an appearance in every book I've written, you know, in a weird little cameo. Sometimes he's unnamed, but you'll know who he is. And actually, he...
I love the idea of you just writing in and going, hello. And that's it. That's all he does.
Well, he's in the new book, but he's just on the end of a phone.
Oh, brilliant.
But he does make... So, yeah, maybe I will tell. Although part of me just doesn't want to engage with this guy.
That's the other side of it, yeah. Maybe just...
That's such a weird stance to take.
It is because,
you know,
it's...
How dare you do that?
But it's not lovely how much he values it and obviously loves it.
Well, do you know what? That's the kind of... the double-edged sword about how attached readers get to characters. There's a book that I would recommend to all your listeners called Books to Die For, which was a book that came out, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. And so they basically gathered, oh, God knows how many, 50 or 60 of the world's, you know, best-known crime writers. And everybody had to write an essay about their favourite crime novel. So I was one of the contributors. I wrote an essay about the Maltese Falcon. And at the World Mystery Convention that year, there was a huge signing. Because about 40 of the writers happened to be there. So they organized this massive book signing, alphabetically, a huge semicircle around this big ballroom. And people were just going around sort of getting everybody's signature. And I was sitting next to Lee Child. And this was just before the Reacher movie came out with Tom Cruise. Wow. And people were screaming at him. I mean, just shouting in his face. How could you? And Lee was very polite about it and just went, you know, well, listen, just wait till you see the film and da-da-da. And I said to him afterwards, how do you cope with that? I mean, that's just... And he said, well, it's kind of flattering.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not nice to be shouted at, but it's sort of flattering that they care about the character that much. And these characters that we create in these long-running series do belong to the reader every bit as much as they belong to you. Ultimately, you decide the direction the story goes in. But yeah, you know, a book is written and it's read, and until it's read, it doesn't exist. And once it's read, then it becomes that reader's every bit as much as it is yours. So I get that. I get why people, you know, God forbid what should happen when you kill a character off. I've seen that as well. I've seen, you know, a writer called Karen Slaughter killed one of her main characters off, spoiler alert. This is a long time ago, but she still gets massive grief about that. You know, people really giving her a hard time. So, you know, you got to be careful.
That's amazing. There, I mean, there are books that I've been heavily invested in.
Not threatening, not threatening the author level, have you?
I don't think so.
No, no, this guy is so weird. I, you know, several times in the last few days, whenever there's been any little publicity thing about the new book, because the proofs of the new book had just gone out. So lots of people are going, oh, book post, look what I got in the post, very excited. He's like, not me. I'm not.
Oh, well, he'll come round. He'll come
around. Maybe he will. Maybe he will.
No, he won't.
No, he won't. No, you're right. He won't. He absolutely won't. He will strengthen his position. You know, he will go into bookshops and actually turn it round on the shelf or hide it. You know, do what he can to sabotage my book sales.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I like to think that when you were sat next to Lee Child that, and he was giving you that, you know, I said, oh, yeah, you just got to, you know, it's not as bad as the guy I had the other week. He collects like all these weird little dolls of like anyone and everything. And you just go, right, anyway. you get all kinds of weirdos, don't
anyway,
you?
Anyway, next. Most crime writers are not weirdos. I mean, we sort of...
Oh, they've got to have... Surely there's got to be something slightly loose in there, hasn't there?
Well...
In the same way that their detective always has a thing.
There's a little quirk.
Yeah, there's always a thing, isn't there? The alcoholism, the... Do you mean Tom Thorne's the sort of the maverick, slightly wild and controlled,
isn't he? Well, I guess the country music is his thing.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
I chose country music for two very good reasons. Firstly, I like it, so he's going to like what I like. But secondly, it's the perfect soundtrack for a crime novel, country music, because proper country music, you know, I'm not talking, you know, Big Hats and Rhinestone.
Stories. Yeah.
You know, I'm talking Hank Williams and Johnny Cash. And these are really dark stories, you know, quite often about murder and loss and revenge and grief and guilt and pain. But they're all told in a really entertaining sing-along tappy feet type of style, which, and that's what crime fiction is at the end of the day. We're telling dark stories, but we're also trying to entertain a reader. So I thought country music was perfect.
Yeah. Mm. Look at you with your literary depth. That's a deep,
How's that? That is quite deep,
isn't
it?
Yeah, that's like a deep,
We've gone from Beatles dolls to an in-depth analysis of musical accompaniment to crime fiction.
Yeah. That was like one of those things you get told in GCSE English when you're reading a book and you think, yeah, the writer didn't mean that.
Yeah, he's just pasted that on afterwards.
But it makes me think when you went, oh, that was a good intelligent point, I'm thinking, oh, is that the only one I've made?
Yeah, no, that's pretty much, I mean, that was, yeah, but that's why we feel like we can end it now.
We can end now. Finally, after an hour,
he's finally made
the point. We've got something worthwhile out of him.
Something salient and erudite to pass on to our listeners.
To be fair, that's usually where we end, because we've got nothing else to say.
often so maybe interviews just end very clunkily in a very unprofessional.
Yeah,
right,
and that's
it then, isn't it?
Ta-da!
Right, now I've finished my lunch, I'm arresting you for being a proper weirdo murderer who eats people rather than, you know, a nice sandwich or something.
But how did you catch me?
I'm one of those savant on the edge detectives with a broken relationship and a drink problem.
Nice one, girl.
What's funny?
It's just that you're so normal.
No, I'm not. I'm a tortured soul, me.
You drink Orangina and listen to the soundtrack from Mamma Mia.
Well, yeah, but, I mean... Why is my marriage on the rocks? Tell you why. Because I'm basically broken and unlovable.
You've been with Judith for 20 years, Gov. Lovely woman. Never heard a cross word between you.
Because I've been bottling up an intriguing yet fatal character flaw for years, and it's about to boil to the surface with catastrophic results.
Look, I don't mean to interrupt, but shouldn't you be arresting me?
What is it, sir? Got one of your gut feelings?
Oh, sort of. I think I need a tummy tit.
What?
Gotta release some brown salmon into the wild.
What?
The chocolate sausage delivery man is knocking at the back door.
Hey, have you got a Ring doorbell thing?
No, I heard that one before.
Still not with you, sir.
He needs a Charlie Flump.
To knit a brown sweater.
Mr. Turtle's heading for the emergency exit.
Father Brown's about to perform an exorcism.
Oh, do you mean you need a number two?
No need to be coy, Constable. We're all adults here. Call it what it is, a poopy plop.
So you need a shit, sir?
Rather. And what about you?
Me?
Yep, need a wee-wee or anything before we go?
No.
Well, we're not stopping once we're going.
I don't need one.
Well, go and try anyway,
I
please.
Don't need
Stop
one.
Stop it. Go and try now, please.
No, I've just had one before.
Fine, get in. You'll be sorry.
All right. Hang on. What's that on your dashboard?
That? Oh, that's one of my Beatles figurines.
What? You collect small, lifelike dolls of people?
Well, yeah, just famous people like Edgar Allan Poe, Elvis Costello, Bender the Robot out of Futurama and the Beatles. You know, just normal stuff.
Bloody hell, Garv, I take it back. You do have problems.
You're more of a freak than I am. And I say that as someone who's just thoroughly enjoyed a human ear for my 11sies.
Tom, I hope Mark's okay.
What do you mean?
Well, we interviewed him, well, I can't remember how long ago, it was quite a while ago now.
Yeah.
And I still haven't seen him release any of my brilliant suggestions for book titles and stories.
You know, it's, I mean, again, I'm astounded at that too, John, because, yeah, I guess he's...
It is weird, isn't
yeah.
it? Do you think he's just taking his time over
I
them?
I think it's possible.
You know what I mean?
He wants
to get them right.
No,
like, really
I think...
do them justice.
I think you might have overwhelmed him with the quality of your suggestions.
Oh, right.
And now he feels like he can't release anything.
Oh, God.
You've undermined his confidence. Oh. Do you know what I mean? You've really kind of...
Sorry, Mark.
He was up there as a big name, doing really well. Do you know what I mean? Bestsellers, all that stuff. And then you've just... He's gone, wow, this guy can just... Wow.
Yeah.
And you've just really...
I've made his backlist look a little bit...
Badly titled.
Like, not
really
well
badly
thought
titled.
Through.
Yeah. So that's probably what it is. I assume that's what... I can't think of another
right, okay.
situation that would...
Well, I genuinely am sorry. Yeah. That was not my intention at all.
No, well, it's going to happen ideas of that quality, John, isn't it?
Well, no, exactly. We should probably say, in the meantime, he has brought out The Last Dance, featuring his new detective, Declan Miller.
I was just going to say,
which
yeah.
came out at the end of May.
Wish him all the best with that.
So obviously that's not going to be as good as some of the other titles, but still I would recommend you go out and... Get your grubby
yeah.
little mitts.
Absolutely, right? yeah. Yeah, yeah. Do, yeah. do, 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 do.
There will be a link in the show notes as well, if you look down, and you can read his latest book. So, Tom, are we going to do another whip it up and start again?
Yep.
What have we got this week?
Oh, just the usual, you know, your classic comedy vampire tale.
Uh-huh.
No, this one has been sent in by Gail, and she says that a couple of people who've read it so far have described it as Anne Rice meets Irvine Welsh.
I think that sets the scene quite nicely, actually,
I mean,
doesn't it?
So if you imagine, is that Annika Rice off, with a yellow jumpsuit?
That's right, yeah.
Mixing that up with Trainspotting.
Yeah.
That's mental!
It is mental.
That is mental! So it's like Treasure Hunt with Trainspotting. I mean, I don't even know where to... Isn't it?
It's a bloody great idea.
What a great... I mean, yeah.
It's already exciting, isn't
what
it?
What did make me laugh about that is it would be... brilliant if two separate people have read it independently and then come back to her and said and described it as Anne Rice meets Irvine Welsh.
That would be good.
Separately.
And I could see why they might say that, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
By the way, do you know, have you remembered that this Gail Ramage, our writer, is the person who very nearly won our Trick or Tweet Halloween comp last year. With that, it was like a twist on the Ring movie.
Yeah.
Remember that
yeah,
one?
Yeah.
Should we have a little listen first?
Yeah.
Do you think I should apologise for my Scottish accent before we begin?
Sorry, you're going to... Are you doing the...
Yeah.
Is that...
Sorry.
Okay. No, that's fine. So here is... I like the title of this as well. Jocula, yet another fucking vampire story. That's quite nice, isn't it?
It is.
So here is the first chapter, or is it it's the prologue, isn't it? Of Jocula, as read by Rab C. Nesbitt.
Jocula by Gail Ramage.
Oh man, this was shite. Just left the club for a puff and some asshole jumped me. A wee creepy bastard by the look of him. Pale as fuck too. Probably a smackhead or something. Well, if he thought he was going to get any money off me, he could piss off. Nobody carried money anymore. It was all contactless shite these days. And my bank card was someplace this creep wouldn't he dare try to put his hands. Tough little fucker too. We struggled as those in the queue still trying to get into the nightclub watched with mild interest.
It's not really something out of the ordinary. Two guys fighting on a Friday night in the city. I'm surprised most of them could be arsed to look up from the small devices in their hands. A lassie with far too much makeup and no enough clothes idly raised a hand and snapped a few pics, all the while chewing the inside of her mouth. The bouncers were of no help. Meathead 1 and Meathead 2 were too busy eyeing up the underage girls giggling amongst themselves, a little too obvious for it to be genuine. Normally, I kept an eye out for the young girls. No, not in that way, you dirty-minded bastards. My wee sister and her friends were of the age where they think they're old enough to drink and flirt with guys triple their age. I've lost count of the times Esme would phone me up, screeching at me to come and help them get out of potentially very dangerous situations. I suppose it's ingrained in me now to protect the silly little girls of the city. This tow rag wasn't getting the message. He tried to clamp a thin hand around my neck while batting away my attempts to punch him. Whoever said you shouldn't judge a book by its cover wasn't joking. This chancer had the strength of Muhammad Ali in his prime.
Oi!
I roared, twisting my neck to look at the bozos at the door.
You gonna help me out here?
Nothing to do with us, mate,
said the one on the left. A cockney. That figured.
Fine.
I growled, then muttered under my breath. Dickhead. I managed to get my arms around the would-be thief's body, trapping his own arms to his sides. That was better.
Fuck off, you pedo,
he cried, trying to free himself, but I had the upper hand now. I bundled him around the corner of the building where the large stinking bins were kept and the streetlights were few. I checked back to make sure nobody had followed us.
Get off me, you pervert,
the kid screeched, again trying to wriggle out of my grasp. The thing was, now that I was in the zone, a fucking 10-ton truck couldn't stop me. I pinned him against the wall, graffiti adorning almost every inch. No Banksy here, just your run-of-the-mill Bezo whiz here shite. Classy.
Oh, didn't he want to be touched now, eh?
You were off of pawing me a moment ago, you dick. This last bit was delivered as a hiss, and I saw the little shit flinch. Good.
I just wanted your money, for fuck's sake,
he protested. Very defensively, I have to say. What for? You druggy. He made a face which turned his ugly goblin features even more hideous.
I didn't take drugs, man. I'm not that stupid.
What did you want it for, then? I said. I was really gagging for a cigarette. A real one, none of those poncy vaping gadgets. So my shithead tolerance level was already fairly low by that stage.
None of your business. He tried to spit in my face. Actually spit in my face.
Luckily, it took too long to draw up enough spit, so I managed to dodge his aim.
Dirty bastard.
It's all of my business, since it was my money you were trying to take.
I will. I balls that up, haven't I? So just let us go, eh?
He'd gone from attack to reason fairly quickly. I looked at him for a moment or two. He was a fairly weedy guy, actually. The adrenaline must have given him the muscle earlier. I really should have let him go. Kicked his ass and sent him on his way. But I had needs. You're definitely not a junkie, I asked, just to make sure. I made a mistake with a lassie full of cocaine back in the mid-90s. Spent the next month feeling pretty fucking awful, I don't mind telling you. Since then, I only go for the untainted stuff. Aye, I'm a classy kind of guy that way. His eyes searched mine. He thought I was going to let him leave. No harm, no foul. And I was going to let him go, once I'd finished with him. I decided to get it over with quickly. Get the timing wrong, and they start screaming and catching the attention of others. It happened once in Birmingham. That's why I can't go back there again. I make like I'm going to release the wee wanker. I feel him relax a little. Then, just as I start to lessen my grip, my new pal looks up the alley, ready to make a run for it. And that's when I make my move. I jerk my head forward and bite down hard, clamping a hand over his mouth. He squirms, but I'm at my strongest pre-feed, so he's got no chance. He tries biting my hand, but I just continue drinking. He could bite my hand clean off. It would just grow back again. And wasn't that a nice surprise the first time it happened? Now, I had no plans to kill him, nor to turn him into one like me. Christ, there's nothing worse than having to mentor a shifty little asshole like him for the rest of my undead days. Oh, aye, I'm a vampire, if you hadn't gathered by now. Hello, I'm Jack. Jack Rushton. Jack to my mates, Jock to my enemies. Jocula to the vampire queen who thinks the name's cute. She's a bitch. But don't tell her I said that.
Well, I hate to say it, John, but you did actually do quite a good job of that. That was
well, I did to you. I mean, the Scottish people out there will probably be twisting.
Probably, yeah, yeah. No, you definitely caught the character of it. And I think that was one of the first things that smacks you out of this. It's lovely, isn't it, how quickly that character is established in it. Do you not think? Like, he kind of just by his use of words and his kind of... is that because this character is all about his attitude, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
That gets sort of solidified so quickly that you're in there.
Definitely. I liked that. I really like the fact that he's not actually that likable in a way. He's a bit of a grumpy twat.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? He's kind of irritable, but he's also funny with it. And he's also got this sort of softer side. He's a bit of a sucker for the girl he works at the local cafe. Yeah. Good character.
Yeah, really good character. Really good
character. Very easy to read this as well, I thought. Like, it's just got really nice flow. There's a lovely energy to it. Do you know what I mean? It reads like you're there.
Do you know what I thought, sort of two pages in, probably halfway, two-thirds of the way through what we've just heard there, was skip the book. This needs to go straight to Netflix. It's got such the feeling. Do you not think of like a slightly off the wall Netflix-esque series?
I do know what
like
you mean.
A bit dark, but kind of a...
Just feel poor Gail getting excited already.
Oh, yeah, like, sorry. Yeah, no, God. Sign up to Netflix. There we go.
Going to Netflix?
Yeah, straight to Netflix. Straight to Netflix. No, yeah, maybe finish this first, Gail. I'm just getting excited because I liked it.
Yeah, no, it is really good.
It had a really nice balance of interaction and dialogue with the building the world and this, like I said, really building that character.
Yeah.
And as we get into the chapter one and chapter two, which you haven't heard, but we've read, there's some just really interesting bits of setting the scene for the future story and conflict. And
yeah.
And it does it all quite quickly, but at no point does it feel rushed or forced. You just feel like this is what's happening to this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's such a gentle touch.
We should hear the little praises that Gail centres of the story as a whole. Do you want me to just read that quickly as well?
Yeah, go for
so
it.
So people know. I was just minding my own business when this creep jumped me, and the next thing I know, I've got a rage on for the old red stuff. I'd become a vampire. But that's not this story. This story is about the ridiculous mission I've been forced to do to keep my living family safe. This story is about being a target for a chosen one who can't be bothered to do the job. Oh, you see, it's in like Scottish dialect and I'm not doing my Scottish accent.
Oh, is that not your Scottish accent? couldn't tell.
This story is about Nosferatu. I, the very one, having bubble baths in my flat. Brace yourself.
I mean, that's just got everything, that, hasn't it?
That's got a bit of everything. Another little thing I spotted, which I thought was really nice, there was like a lovely, subtle subversion of expectation at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Jack's description of his assailant as a wee, creepy bastard, pale as fuck, tough little fucker too, it made me think that the guy who jumped him might be the vampire. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Because he's pale, he's hard, and he's little and creepy.
Yeah.
And I thought very briefly that Jack is about to become the victim. And I really liked that a lot. I liked it so much. It made me think, if you could, for a bit of fun, you could push that a lot further. And it might be quite interesting. Might make a really interesting opening if we're led to think that the main character is about to become the victim. Because it would be more tense.
Yeah, yeah.
Because at the moment, I don't know if you felt like this, but Jack... he's never really out of control, is he?
I was going to say, there is an element of him being too much in control, a bit too cocksure.
Yeah, there's no, like, massive tension. It's the first bit of the book, and there's not a lot of tension in it, actually.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, what if you made him appear as though he's the victim? And maybe, like, Jack, the main character, the vampire guy, he could run away, even, down an alley. And you think he's doing it because he's scared, but actually he's trying to draw them.
He's luring them, into
so can bite
the dark corner.
And obviously, Gail, you can completely ignore this, and you probably will. But I just thought it might be quite fun to write a version where he's sort of grifting the mugger into thinking that he's got the upper hand. But at the same time, he's leading us along as well.
I think that's the kind of feedback that Gail will listen to. I think that's good. You're going, yeah, that's actually a good idea.
Yeah, but you'd worry about it and you'd think this guy is a vampire and he's going to get him and that's bad. But
that's the kind of thing a Netflix executive would say, wouldn't it? That's what you need to do. definitely.
It is build attention.
That would be a nice little twist there. Yeah.
But anyway, just food for thought, Gail, food for thought. I need to give a special mention to a really beautiful moment in the I think it's the following chapter.
Yeah, go on.
You know when you get some wordplay that is so perfect that it actually brightens your day?
Yeah.
It's one of them. And you know exactly what I'm going to say now, don't you?
Yeah.
So he says, I wasn't really a fan of coffee, especially the pretentious shite you get these days, but I needed to get rid of the taste of iron in my mouth. Truth be told, I didn't actually like the taste of blood. Irony indeed. Oh, come on. That is a gold star.
It is, and with the with the accent, doesn't it? It works.
Yeah.
Double hard.
It's beautiful.
If you can imagine someone with a Scottish accent reading it, people.
it actually being good. Yeah. we need a gold star sonic sting for that, I think. For these moments, we need to produce up a little sting.
Yeah.
We could do that, couldn't we? With the power of post-production. Yeah. Well, you were talking before, Tom, about how Gail sets up the rules.
Yeah.
She sets up the world. She builds the world really well, but she also sets up the rules of the vampire world.
Yeah, there's a few of those little dropped in.
It's an important thing to do, isn't it?
It's quite a nice idea that there's the old vampires and the new vampires, and the old ones are still on the old rules and they can't go out in daytime, whereas the new ones can do. They feel a bit sick, but they can manage
they just feel a bit hungover, yeah.
So there's different rules for the different generations, which is quite a good setup, I assume, for that.
I thought it was great because you're sort of cleverly retaining, you know, the rules that you know, but you've just moved it. You've moved the whole thing on a little bit.
Yeah.
Nice. I like the transforming into a bat really fucking hurting.
That was a great sequence, wasn't it? That he just didn't like it, and it was
the idea.
I don't know. Feel me, like, you know, when you got like travel sick as a kid or something. You know, it just felt like that.
I don't like this.
God.
But I love the idea that your body aches for days afterwards.
Yeah.
Little details like that are nice.
Because you've been flying, and why wouldn't it? Of course it would. Your arms would be sore, wouldn't they?
And your body is like contorted into what I think she describes as the arse end of a rodent or something.
Yeah.
A flying rodent. Yeah, details like that. Lovely. And you can also use stuff like that as plot points later on, can't you? You can either use them to sort of disadvantage the main character so that they're in a real spot. You know, their body's aching and they've got to take on the bad guy. Or you can sort of use them with the antagonist, you know, do you know what I mean? If you want a nice way to beat them, the antagonist, you could sort of trick the antagonist into turning into a bat or something, and then they'll feel like they're beaten up or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, very nice.
Really good. Really
good. Have you got any criticism?
I did notice there's a lot of words spelt wrong in it, isn't there?
It took me a second there, Tom. I was like,
instead
what?
Of cannot. It's littered with them, John. It's littered with spelling mistakes.
Like the word canne.
Canne, that's not a word,
I mean,
is it?
Come on.
Well, how's that not
you
been picked up by the spell check?
How did that not get through the spell check?
I don't know. I don't know. Sad for me, that made it very difficult to read. I thought, well, amateur hour. That's a lot of misspellings. But apart from that, I said I felt it had a really good balance to it, that there wasn't too much description versus dialogue. I always think that's quite important in stuff because they move the story on in slightly different ways and build the character and the interactions in different
really
ways.
Really good voice.
Good dialogue and quite a lot of story squeezed in, really. Like, you felt like it was moving along at quite a pace.
Yeah. Doesn't hang around.
Kind of got straight into the action, didn't it?
Totally.
Having been dragged in front of the... drag queen vampire.
I've got a recommendation. It's a stupid tiny little thing. No, it's not a big
apologies in advance, Gail. Here we go.
I would say don't call that first bit the prologue.
Oh, John, just I thought that actually one. When I was reading it, I thought, well, why is that a prologue?
Yeah.
It's just the start,
isn't
it?
It's just the first chapter, that. And it works great as a first chapter. And because some people have really weirdly strong opinions about prologues, but you just don't need to do it. You might as well bypass the controversy of the prologue.
I didn't really understand why that was a prologue, really, because it was right. It's literally straight before what happened. It's not like it's...
Yeah, we're not sort of going back to the past or
massively previous. It's literally just before. Yeah, I think that's possibly something to think about, actually. Yeah.
Another thought. Again, it's not criticism, just a passing thought.
Oh, God, he's got another one. Yeah,
but it occurred to me, and this, I suppose this is a similar kind of thought to the upping of the tension in the first chapter, that you could maybe up the stakes for Jack even more. And of course, I have no idea where the story goes, and the stakes might get upped and upped and upped, and I'm sure they do. But could you have an even more direct threat to Jack's family? And maybe to him. Do you know what I mean? Like some reference to having him staked, although I don't think that works in the new vampire rules. But having him taken out if he doesn't perform the task that the vampire queen wants him to. Do you know what I mean? Then you've got this 3-day countdown that she gives him to complete his task. It's not a vague threat. It's like you and your family will die if you don't do this thing for me.
Yeah.
You've got yourself a proper ultimatum that drives the story.
I think often in stories like this narrative, what's used quite well is where there's two threats to the character that are having to balance between and decide which is the lesser evil and how to get away with one and the other.
And sometimes you forget about one for a while.
Yeah, and it's kind of like
and you sort of defeat one baddie and then the other one appears. It's like, oh,
yeah,
no.
And I think just completely rewrite it, Gail, for my, I've just had that thought now, so I would, yeah.
But you could, I definitely think you can up the tension. I think it works with the comedy as well, because I was going to say, you know, I sort of appreciate it's a comedy horror genre. But I don't think that means you can't go big with the threat.
I think it often means you need to ramp it up more, to be honest, to kind of
maybe.
To poke through. Otherwise, if you don't go far enough, it always comes across as a bit kind of like, oh, it's all just... You don't get the resonance and the satisfaction from the story as much because it is just kind of a jolly jaunt.
Yeah.
So you kind of do need to almost up the ante, I think sometimes.
So. Blake Snyder says, make the bad guys badder, doesn't he?
Mm.
And I think that is, you know... Really go for the threat. I don't have anything else. I thought I really enjoyed reading that.
Yeah, thank you for sharing with us. I did enjoy it.
Thank you.
Such a really good idea.
Yeah.
You know, like the starting germ of it.
The title. I think we talked about the title before.
Yeah.
But you must have been so pleased with that, Gail. When that dropped into your mind, that must have been a good day because it's so perfect. It sets up the style, the sense of humour. It sets up the genre. It tells you what kind of story it's going to be with one word. So, yeah, a little round of applause there, Gail. Well done.
Full marks. Thank you, Gail.
Yeah, brilliant.
So if you've been listening to that thinking, well, they say quite nice things, don't they, when people send in decent stuff? Send in your decent stuff, and we'd love to read it. First three chapters, or if you fancy sending a prologue and two chapters for no reason, do that as well. That's fine. And we'd love to read it and give you our completely unqualified and worthless opinion on it.
Yeah, we might even do like a really shit Scottish accent for it as well.
Change whatever you've written, no matter what it is, change it into like some, I don't know, some abstract African
really
dialect that involves
accent.
Clicks or something like that. And we'll try it.
Yeah.
We'll try it.
Yeah.
We don't mind
well,
getting cancelled.
We'll try anything.
As long as, you know, just for content, that's fine. Whatever.
Well, hey, we should probably wrap it up there. Listen, genuine...
Yeah, let's wrap it up because I'm... desperate to get writing.
Yes, me too. But just want to say thank you all for listening, you beautiful, amazing writer people. And thanks for putting up with us, your very patient people.
Yeah.
And if you have any inclination, it would be lovely if you hit subscribe. Give us a nice review on Apple.
Yeah.
If you're very rich, send us a few grand.
Yeah. If you're on Twitter, retweet our episode thing.
Yeah.
Tell people about it.
All helps. All helps.
Using these exact words. I'm not finished, John. Using these exact words. Oh, my God. This is the best podcast ever. You have to listen. Then put in a link to our podcast.
That's all we ask.
Those exact words, please. Thank you.
But not all of you. It might look a bit weird.
No, everyone. Because then people are just getting to think, wow, what is it? Everyone's saying this. That's how it works these days, John.
Oh, I see.
We can't afford to set up a bot farm. We have to use real people to pretend to be bots.
Us.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, yeah.
Thinking.
That's what we do. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's put our begging bowls away and we'll see you next time
on
the Failing Writers Podcast. When? What are we doing? We do this every time. Oh, I know what we're doing. We are revealing the results of the task that was set by Jack Meggett Phillips in the previous episode.
Are we?
And we'll be reading out,
what were you reading out?
The opening chapters of our children's books, hopefully, if we've written them by then.
Oh. Right, okay.
So, yeah.
Good.
So if you have a spare child knocking around, bring them along.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you might want to let us know how our stories were received by actual children.
It's going to be, there's a certain irony to the next podcast then, isn't it? As we read out our stuff, which will undoubtedly be average at best, and then critique someone else's pretty good writing that they've sent in. It's kind of a bit, yeah.
It will be quite nice, actually. It'd be nice for people to hear. And then you could send in your critique of us, and we'll read out that the following
And then
week.
We'll critique their critique. Oh, no, this could, no, this will never end. Ever decreasing circles.
Oh, speaking of critiques, I've just remembered the other exciting thing that's happening in that episode.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned this ages ago, and I've been saying, can we do that? Can we do that? And you're like, there's not enough time.
Yeah.
Well, there will be enough time. John entered a competition.
Yeah.
And
a short story competition quite a long time ago.
We're discussing the judges' feedback.
Yeah. So we'll read the feedback.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
Explaining why it wasn't very good. And I know that you all...
Wow, it's going to be a critique feedback-a-thon.
It is. Let's call it that.
Yeah.
The feedback-a-thon of the episode.
Right. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. We'll speak to you then.
Right. Let's go and do something else now.
Writing a bloody start of a kid's story by the sound of it. Quite about that.
There's a little bit of a fly in the ointment, actually, isn't it? Because I'm quite busy
this
week. But anyway, we have to do it. It's a task.
Can't be that hard writing a kid's story, can it?
Well, that's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm thinking.
Jack made it sound easy.
You just put, like, fart jokes in it and stuff, don't
you? Yeah, yeah.
A couple of fart jokes. Bosh.
Yeah.
Do you think people are still listening to this, Tom? Us rambling on?
I very much doubt it. I feel like it actually finished about 3-4 minutes ago.
Okay, everyone, you can leave now. Literally, you can leave. There's nothing worth listening to beyond this point.
Yeah, that's it. We're done. Done.
Or is there?
Mm.
Maybe there's, like, a secret competition. And this is just, like, a sneaky test. Only for the most loyal of our listeners who listen right to the
late-end listener
club. Could be something really special waiting for you. No, there isn't. We're just wasting your time.
Silly.
You could be listening to something good now.
Like a true crime podcast. People like those, don't they?
Yeah. Well, like The Rest is Politics. Oh. Or something serious.
Serious,
like
something heavyweight, yeah. Or one of those really funny ones that has, like, a comedian.
Yeah, well, like actual funny people.
Well-known comedian talks about what's in someone's bins or something. Do you mean, like, they just go through each other's bins?
Yeah.
That's like, that's quite a good idea.
That is quite good. Top 10 things I found in a bin.
No, you get a famous comedian. It would be, who would it be currently? James Acaster, probably, wouldn't it?
I mean, you're going pretty high end there, but yeah.
And you send him out. He goes through Elton John's bin. And then, without Elton John knowing, he doesn't know he's gone through his bin. And then he puts certain things from the bin in a smaller bin that then he takes to, and it costs Elton John, and then talks about what's in his bin.
It's really good, Tom.
In a comedy
it's
fashion.
Really good.
And it doesn't have to be Elton John. That would work with Phil Collins.
Yeah, no, it would totally. Wouldn't it? You're right. Any of those stars of yesteryear.
Noel Edmonds, he'll have a bin. God knows what'll be in his bin. All kinds of stuff.
It's good. It's really good. Yeah, there's literally no one listening now.
Oh, God, are we still going?
Yeah.
Is that going in?
We're still going.
Right, is that still...
Hey,
wow,
do you know what?
A...
We should reward the people who have listened this long with actually something.
I'm not sure we should reward such bad behaviour because it's not smart, is it? It's not like reward...
They've not done very well.
It's not very clever. But
no.
Go on then, what would you...
Well, I was thinking, let's give... we're doing our merch at the moment, right?
Yeah.
I'm thinking, how about we give £50 to the person who emails us the best writing-related slogan for a T-shirt, the best design that would go on a Failing Writers T-shirt. And if we use it in our merch, you get 50 squids and the T-shirt.
Wow. Okay.
So that's the prize. Bosh, like that.
So really, like a line that works across all kinds of writers or... touches a nerve, rings a bell.
Yeah, with writers specifically.
Chimes with writers. So
works well with Failing Writers podcast. Yeah.
So something about not finishing or being too busy to write or...
Don't write it for them, Tom.
Using too many adverbs.
Whoa. Are you going for the 50 quid now?
Might do, actually, yeah.
Anyway, have a go. And if you write something good, email your writing-related slogan that you'd like to see on one of our T-shirts to failingwriterspodcast@gmail.com. And £50 and that T-shirt will be yours. You see? So you're glad you listened to the end?
Yeah, but at least there's something for them, isn't it?
Hello?
Hello?
Where's everybody gone?